Velkommen til Spirituell. Dette en podcast som utforsker det å leve et spirituelt liv. Å være spirituell betyr ikke å være gal. Det handler om å utforske sitt indre, gjerne gjennom meditasjon eller yoga. Mitt navn Håkon, jeg høyskolelektor i selvledelse, og jeg elsker å snakke med folk om hvordan de lever sitt spirituelle liv. I dag får jeg besøk av Jeff Frieders, en mann som har flyttet fra California til Oslo, og i dag lever et dypt spirituelt liv her, der han også yogainstruktør, spesielt innenfor Ashtanga-yoga. Jeg gleder meg til å høre hva han har å si. Ok, hey Jeff.
Hei Håkon.
Let's do this in English. I know you can talk Norwegian, but how many years have you been here in Oslo?
5 years, this 2 days ago.
Yeah, wow.
Or last Wednesday. I've lost track of days, but yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with English, so let's just do this in English.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've been wanting to talk to you just because you're a very good yoga teacher, but also just a very spiritual guy. When you walk around, you look very peaceful and zen, and we need to pick your brain a little bit about how your life is, I think.
Yeah, to see if it's really just a mask or not.
Yeah, right. Maybe that's it. So, when did you start becoming spiritual? From like childhood, or is it like a recent thing, or what would you say?
Yeah, I grew up in the Catholic Church, actually. But I think that I connected with nature, really, from the beginning. I grew up on a farm in California. Mm. Connecting with my dogs. I really, really had a deep connection to my dogs that I grew up with. We had several. We used to raise dogs for a little bit. And we had many other animals, pigs and goats and chickens. And yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the natural world hit me first, and then the organized religion came next. And I actually had joined the Catholic Church as an altar boy after I had gone through what in the Catholic Church is called First Communion, and you go through this whole study of the Bible and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I had a good friend of mine who also was an altar boy. So we'd go together. So it was kind of fun to be together, and we'd hang out after on Sundays.
And you're a teenager? Or?
Yeah, I think I was like, yeah. What was it, 12? Yeah, between 10 and 13, maybe I was 14 as an altar boy. But I was the only person in my family going to church at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually like, really, I kind of wanted to be with my family, but I also liked that I was alone, that it was like my process.
Was that what you liked about it, being alone, or why were you drawn?
I think I really liked the ritual. You know, I had to help the priest, you know, with all of the rituals of the mass, the Catholic mass.
Yeah.
You know, from like helping him prepare the cloths that he'd put like on his robe, and like the jewelry, and then the hosts that you eat, and the wine, and you know, lighting the candles. Yeah, it's very ritualistic and symbolic,
and during the rituals, you also enjoyed them.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and I think there was this element of I mean, you know, it's the Catholic Church is very theatrical, and it's very engaging in that way. And there's music, and you know, and I had to memorize some prayers, and so it was kind of like both sort of it held me up to a standard. Like I had to sort of be something. So yeah. I had to have a sense of responsibility. And I think that always made me question more about, like, okay, so what's beneath all of this? What's beneath all these rituals? And And I always had a hard time really connecting deeply to the teachings. I was always searching for more, but I would pray at home, and I was kind of superstitious as well. You know, I do things like in a certain order, a certain way to try to find comfort. And it would like bring me back to a center. Even like playing with my toys, you know, I'd have like certain things that I would do with my toys, certain toys first mm-hmm. before the other toys, yeah. you know.
Create meaning.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. So that's where it started. And then I went to a Catholic high school, and then I had to learn about Christianity,
yeah.
and we took comparative religion classes, and then that's when I really started opening up for me, and I started seeing the Bible as more of a history lesson and less of a faith-based spiritual practice.
Yeah,
and I started to question things and a very specific. I remember very specific moments that were very. Like key in making me like very specific moments of words and phrases in that we studied in the Bible that were kind of like I never really knew, and then when we started learn the meaning of them then it really was like okay, this doesn't resonate with me.
Oh yeah, it didn't.
No, it didn't. Yeah, because
I guess something does and something doesn't, you know.
Yeah, I was putting the pieces together and I was realizing that it was just a really beautiful, there were beautiful analogies of life, you know, and similar to the way that we view mythology. So, yeah, but I definitely value my upbringing in the Catholic Church and in Catholic high school. I think it was very...
Yeah, it sounds like it taught you a lot and it was a good stepping stone in a way.
Yeah.
Like the term spiritual, and when did you like take that step and understood what that was?
When did I understand what the term spiritual was?
Yeah, kind of like in my life, it was so late. You know, I was 33.
Yeah.
When I understood what it was, and I'm not sure if you're in a church like yours,
mm-hmm.
do they talk a lot using that term? Did you know the meaning of it from an early age, or were you an adult and figured it out?
No. I mean, to be honest, I didn't really come into understanding spirituality more, or the term itself, even until. I mean, every day, I guess now you know it changes every day, but I think. But I think really it wasn't until I moved to Norway when I started to have a much more dedicated spiritual practice after I had moved here.
Yeah.
Mm.
And yeah. And why did that happen? A deeper spiritual practice, I mean.
Yeah. Why did that happen?
Yeah.
My ex-wife, you know, she's half American, half Norwegian. We moved here together. And you know, we had a beautiful transition here into this country, but then over time, you know, some things changed and we tried to work things out, and through that process of, you know, a slow separation, it was I learned a lot about myself. So
yeah.
And having the mirror of another culture really it was like I got to start over again. I had this blank slate, you know, and I could kind of rewrite my story and really ask the questions, who am I? Because I didn't have so many of the cultural mirrors that I was used to, you know. And so I really had to kind of, it was more about, it felt more like looking into an abyss than looking into a lake that I had swam in for many years, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, so I've heard that before you moved here, you did like theater and stuff in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Not so much theater in LA. I moved there for film.
Yeah, ended up for film.
Yeah, but ended up doing film production because I found it to be more creative and I wanted to be an actor, but I shifted into film production and worked in restaurants and bars. So I became also very much a restaurant bar professional.
I've always thought that you were spiritual in that period, but it's quite recent when you came here.
Yeah, I've always sort of dipped in and out of spirituality.
You had the foundation of knowledge from your upbringing with nature and church.
Yeah. And I discovered yoga quite early. I was 16.
That's so early.
And then at the same time, I discovered rock climbing. And so they both became this spiritual practice. But I didn't really, I didn't really dive into much of the scripture around yoga.
The philosophy,
the meditation. I did dive into some Zen with an old friend of mine.
You did what? You did?
Some experiences with Zen meditation, Japanese Zen, Buddhist meditation, Zen Buddhism. So a friend of mine was, when I was living in Seattle, a very good, actually my old climbing partner, he was a Zen Buddhist. He's now converted to Judaism, but we both have, we were actually really great mirrors for each other because I'd say we were both very spiritual at the time, but I didn't really have the framework. I didn't really have like a set practice. I was practicing different styles of yoga, but I think I came back to more of my child self of connecting to nature. So I spent a lot of time in nature, climbing outdoors. I worked in Alaska for a few summers. Mm. I traveled a lot into nature, backpacking, hiking.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like you lived a quite spiritual life without having yet read the theoretical framework, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that is correct, yeah. And it wasn't until I landed here in Norway that I started to really really take the time to learn more on my own.
Yeah. What was one of the first books or knowledge that you took in that was...
Yeah, the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Yeah.
The Yoga Sutras.
Yeah.
You went straight there.
I went straight there. I mean, I did actually have the book when I was in college.
Yeah, okay.
I had a yoga teacher in college that was also one of my acting instructors. She was a voice instructor.
Mm.
And we over the course of 3 years, we would sort of go through the sutras. So I guess I did study the sutras early in college.
Yeah.
But then, again, I really think it all comes back down to intention, you know, because I didn't feel like I was seeking a spiritual path per se. Mm. I was really focused on learning more about acting in college and then working professionally in the theater and then climbing and sort of balancing those two very different worlds. And then, you know, it's when you start to go through the dark night of the soul of really, you know, leaving your culture behind, moving to a new country. And that's
when you need the spirituality more, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people seek in one way or another, whether it's climbing mountains or, you know, meditation or in a book. But yeah, so I say the sutras I've always come back to.
Hmm.
And they've come around in different waves for me.
Yeah.
Mm.
I've read the sutras now.
Yeah.
With commentary, of course, because I wouldn't understand anything. It was just...
Yeah, you need the commentary, absolutely. Yeah.
It's quite deep, I would say. Yeah. Took me a long time to read it.
Yeah. And it's, you can keep coming back to it and it changes and there's different... Yeah, of course, as you know, different translations, different commentaries. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so then you were in Oslo,
mm-hmm.
and you went deeper, and you do a lot of yoga also as an instructor. Then I guess you started then.
No, I didn't start as an instructor right away. I guess overall I've been practicing for about 20 years. I've been a student, you know, So mainly a student most of my life. But I've always leaned more towards teaching, I guess, or teaching as a I don't know what you call it. Teaching in general, I think I'm drawn to.
Yeah, like, you seem like a natural teacher.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I think that's what my mom always told me. I could see you as a teacher.
Yeah. And now you are.
And now I am, yeah. I wanted to be a history teacher originally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then I found the theater. And,
well, a spiritual teacher and a history teacher is very similar.
Yeah.
Both history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Plus knowledge, kind of.
Yeah.
Wisdom. Mm.
But yeah, I discovered that I wanted to be a teacher. It was after COVID. You know, I had gone through, I'd lost my job managing a bar, and it had been like a few years that I was ready to shift careers and change, but I never really had the courage or never really knew how. I think deep down I knew how, but I was just too scared to really take the leap.
You needed to lose your job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
And it was the winter of 20, well then it was 2021, entering into 2021.
Tough winter.
Yeah. That's when I registered for a Vipassana retreat, which I had been wanting to do for a long time.
Can you say what the Vipassana retreat is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Vipassana, also known as insight meditation, it's a style of meditation, a style of practice that is, they believe, the closest to the original teachings of the Buddha. Mm. Essen Goenka was the guy who had brought it back about. I can't remember how many years ago now, but in mid-century, I believe it was. But the practice has been around for a long time, but he kind of helped spread it more throughout the world, building more retreat centers. But anyway, there's one in Sweden, and the practice is you traditionally start with going for 10 days. Mm. It's a silent retreat, and then it takes about 3 days or so to kind of land into the process of into the practice. You meditate for about 8 hours a day ish, somewhere around there. Yeah. And
guided, or do you just sit there?
You sit there. Yeah, there is a teacher. There is there's many people in the space, and there's someone that you can talk to about the process, and they have like a evening lecture that continues with the sort of the practice and asking any questions. You have a little time with each with the teacher. And there's like a crew of people that help run the retreats. But the thing was, is it got canceled because of COVID, because there was like the numbers increased in Sweden.
So you never went.
So I never went, but I decided, you know, I'd already prepared for it. I had read the book, Goenka's book, and I had a good friend that had done it many times. And so he kind of helped prepare me for it. And so I did a 7-day silent retreat at home in my apartment. And it,
you did?
Yeah.
You're so determined.
I was very determined. And, you know, I'd been waiting for a while to do this. And you have to be on a wait list, and they fill up quickly. And
so to anyone who wants to go to a festival or anything and it gets canceled, just...
have your house party at home. Exactly. Why not?
Just find the artist on Spotify at home and have a good time.
Have a 3 or 4 day rave in your own home.
Yeah, exactly. And that was successful.
It was. Yeah. I mean, it's not from talking to my girlfriend now. She used to be in. She had done it for 5 years and was actually like assisting the retreats and staying for longer periods of time. And so after talking to her, it's like Yeah, I didn't really have the actual experience. Of course, how could I have? I wasn't at the retreat center. I wasn't feeling the energy of everyone else in the space. I didn't have the support of the teacher or of the other people in the space. And I think that there's something really about committing to the actual tradition. I think there's a lot of power in being able in committing to a lineage. There's a lot, you know, a lineage that's been around for so long, and that there's been so many teachers that have carried it. So to make it a little bit more palatable for myself, to make it a bit more easy to digest, I decided that I would have an hour long yoga practice every day. And then I also paired it with I didn't fast, but like I ate one meal a day around midday, and then drank tea in the afternoon and cut out caffeine
like the Buddha.
Yeah, is that what he did?
He had one meal a day.
One meal a day, yeah.
It was a story. Someone came and said to him, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, don't feel I have energy. And Buddha asked, how many times a day do you eat? Only two. And he said, try one.
Okay.
Yeah, it was an important thing for him.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel, I believe in that as well. I think we eat way more than we need to.
Oh, we eat so much more.
So
our poor bodies, you know.
Yeah, so much work we're putting them through.
But I have to ask about this 7-day at home.
Yeah.
Was this during COVID?
Yes. It was in the middle of winter.
It's the perfect thing to do during COVID.
It was perfect.
But were you then complete silence, or did you have 1 hour where you could talk to yourself, kind of?
No, I was in complete silence. Yeah.
Yeah, and
I put my phone on. Like I shut it off
For the whole week.
Yeah.
Not 5 minutes on.
No.
And is that hard? Because you talk to yourself in your mind, obviously, but maybe less and less then. Or tell me what happens.
Yeah, the first couple of days were very difficult.
Why?
There's so much chatter in our minds,
yeah.
You know. There's so many patterns in the body and in the mind. So sitting for longer, you know. I had prepared by sitting 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening the week before. And then 2 weeks before, I was sitting 1 hour in the morning. And also, you know, reducing my impressions beforehand. So like being mindful of what I watch, being mindful of what I eat, you know, I cut out all alcohol and drugs. And so that, I believe that really helped, but it still was quite difficult.
I think what you did is way harder than being on a 10-day silent retreat with many people, a lot of stimulation, so much body language and communication, nonverbal communication, you know. And even they have like secrets in the evening where you can talk to someone and share. What you did is hardcore. I would say it's many times as hard. I've been on silent retreats, but it's not that hard because it's so much communication in smiles and looks, and you can even talk now and then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I did go out. I had like I wrote down these little, I had like little pieces of paper, and I wrote on them like both in English and Norwegian, like please don't talk to me, or I'm sorry I can't talk. So I would go out because I figured like I need some fresh air, and I know that on the retreat they allow some walking outside. Yeah. So every day I'd go out for like a 90-minute walk, and just walk in the snow in the park, and I would try not to make eye contact with people and just walk.
Yeah,
and that was really, that also helped.
Did you have to use the notes? I would think in Norway no one wants to talk to strangers anyway. How many notes did you use? In none, LA, you none. Would have used them all
exactly.
In 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. No, I didn't use them at all. But they but you know, you never know if you run it. It's a small slow, right?
It was very,
you never know who you run into
you,
here.
Yeah.
So, but no, it was a very, it was the hardest thing I've ever done.
Oh yeah.
And one of the best things I've ever done. My sleep was amazing.
Really?
And I only wanted to sleep, I could only sleep like no more than 6 hours, but like between 4.5 to 6 hours, because I was, you know, I was in a meditative state all day.
Yeah, and then you slept straight and it was deep, fantastic sleep.
Deep sleep.
Yeah. Vivid. Think about that, like with all the people just like watching stuff, thinking, stressing before bed. Watching their phones until they fall asleep, scrolling, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The vividness of the dreams, the depth of the dreams, like very like profoundly symbolic dreams that arose, you know? Just,
really?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, because the shamans, they talk so much about your dreams, how important they are.
Yeah.
And in my life, I mostly dream about traveling and partying with friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I do that much in my life anymore, but that's what I do. But I think that's because a lot of what I take in through media and stuff is maybe I take in too much media. And also maybe I see a lot of traveling and partying there, you know. But maybe if I still my mind, I have done it in silent retreats, but I didn't notice my dreams.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they get more real if you take down the stimulus level.
Yeah, I do feel that. I felt like it was sort of like I was dumping my hard drive the first few days for sure, just like just cleaning it out.
Yeah,
and then I was uploading like subconscious material and like things that I maybe hadn't really allowed myself to feel in a long time.
Can you give an example? If you can't think of it, we can just wait. But you said some subconscious material that arose.
I think it, you know, just things that I think about my relationship at the time. Also, my place here in Norway, you know, sort of these bigger questions around both ego, identity, and relationships.
It sounds like it was like guiding voices coming from the deep, kind of.
Yeah. I feel like since then I've had more profound insights into my life through daily spiritual practice. Which at the time I was having daily spiritual practice, but you know, I still carried a lot of impressions, and really, I think for me it was really important to give up alcohol, and it was after that 7-day retreat that I gave up alcohol.
Were you told by the deeper inside you that you don't need that anymore?
No, actually, it came more. It came after.
Yeah,
and I mean, as I'm sure you know, as a lot of people who've had either shamanic or retreat experiences or any sort of deep experience in your life, there's the integration period after, which is just as important as the experience itself, right?
Yeah.
And for me, that's when I didn't feel like so much.
Yeah, I would think that after that week you went out, you must feel so stimulated. And just having alcohol on top is just like, it's just too much, you know?
Yeah.
Just walking outside the door saying hi to someone must be like, whoa, what a party, you know?
Yeah. And you really feel how impressions hit you, you know? But I haven't been off on a silent retreat outside of the city. And again, I was walking around the city during that retreat. So I was taking in impressions. I was sort of in the buzz of the city still, even though it was COVID and rather quiet, but yeah, I mean, just from people that I've talked to, that entering back into this collective society that we choose to live in is definitely very intense. I mean, you probably had that experience when you've been off on retreats as well.
Yeah. I've just been on a retreat last week and I've taking it very slow these 3 days after.
Good.
just sitting in my apartment, looking at the trees, going to the shop. It's just like so simple.
I mean, you have a perfect place to enjoy.
Yeah.
It's so nice.
But I just to comment on the thing with sleep. So many people struggle with sleep.
Mm-hmm.
What if they try 4 days without, for example, media consumption? Is it worth it, you think?
I mean, I'm not a sleep scientist, but I would, from what I read in Why We Sleep by, what's his name? Michael, I forget his name.
I can't remember the name, but I've read a little bit in that book.
Yeah. Just from what he's researched and also from my own experience, I think this dips into yoga philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, like, you know, the impressions we take in absolutely affect us. And
our brain is so tired. You know this analogy with it's your brain is a muscle and it gets tired, it needs to relax. That's what you do in meditation, kind of.
Yeah.
And when I, at the uni I work, my students, like, it's never a second without the phone.
Mm.
And they have the energy drink in the other hand.
Mm.
And it's not everyone, of course, but most. And it's just like, it's just ongoing.
Yeah.
Information.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why Silicon Valley executives take digital detox retreats and has like huge and popular, and, you know, and it's growing as well.
Yeah.
I think
it's getting very spiritual in Palo Alto now.
Yeah.
Probably has for decades, but it's just growing.
Yeah, I think Steve Jobs was quite spiritual.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He was deep. Didn't he launch iTunes and the only book on the marketing campaign was the... What's that book called again? Oh, the Indian guy who went to US and made it famous. Life of a Yogi.
Yeah.
The Life of a Yogi.
Did he? That was the only book.
That was the only book. It was like a worldwide marketing campaign of Apple iTunes, and that was the one book that showed.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So he's cool.
That's cool.
I've heard also that he was a quite harsh boss for many years, and then he tapped into Buddhism and meditation, and he was milder and more compassionate, and he actually got a much better leader the last 10-15 years.
It's interesting because he started with transcendental meditation in the very beginning, when I think after he left Reed College he went to, it's been a while since I read his biography, but I think he went to India after that and then got back and was obviously very profoundly influenced by that, and I think had, you know, experimented with LSD and other things, and but I think he maybe slid off the spiritual wagon a bit and got more into the capital salesman that he was for a while.
It's hard, right? One thing is to find spirituality interesting, like he obviously did from the beginning then.
Yeah.
And one thing is to understand the deep insight.
Mm.
And I think, I'm just thinking this out loud now, but to see if you're compassionate or not,
mm-hmm.
and to really listen,
mm-hmm.
that's like, that's a really good way of seeing if someone has understood the practice or not. I would say that.
Yeah.
If you're in your own head,
then
you can't have understood the whole practice, you know?
Yeah.
Because we're all connected.
Yeah. And I think... it's more challenging to have a consistent, deep spiritual practice living in the modern world.
Oh, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes over your whole life.
Mm.
Yeah.
And now that I'm recently a stepdad, and as you know, as a father, that itself is a practice. You know, it's as they say in the Ashtanga community, you know, the seventh series is the family practice.
Yeah.
So
the seventh series.
Yeah, so there's six physical postural series.
And I'm only on the first one, right? And it's seven. Well, I do number 1 and 7 then.
Yeah.
I just skip 2 to 6.
Yeah, there's 4 advanced series,
yeah.
1 intermediate and 1.
Wow.
And the primary. Yeah, it's pretty wild. But yeah, the 7th is the one in family.
Hmm.
And I really feel that. I really feel that now. And I wasn't expecting that I'd be going down that road. You know, I've only dedicated myself to Ashtanga like full on for a little over a year now.
Mm.
So not that long. But like I said, I've practiced many other practices of yoga. But Ashtanga really resonates with me deeply. And I look forward to the journey. But I wasn't expecting to step into the 7th series right bonus. Away. But now, I mean, for example, you know, yesterday, you know, I'm leaving for California tomorrow. And so my partner and her son are going to be here for all of July. I'm going to go for some work and be with family and really deeply connect. And I just needed to deeply connect with them this weekend. And, you know, CD, my partner, asked me if I wanted to come home and take a practice in the afternoon and come home early after being out in the city on a beautiful bike tour all day. And I said, no, this is my practice today. And I didn't want to, you know, I really, that's what I'm working on right now is of course my dedicated physical and meditation practice, but also really feeling like really listening to my body, really listening to what I need outside of that. And I'm really enjoying dedicating myself more to the family practice, to being there and just really being present with what is happening.
It's so hard. Sounds so simple, but it's just so hard.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it can be. But I think it's also so beautiful at times. I mean, I'm new to this, so you know, you have how many years on me with being a dad?
4. Yeah.
4. Yeah.
But when I say it's so hard, it's really hard to be present all the time. Like it's not even possible. But it's not hard to be above average in the society. That's very simple. But then to be present and notice, always notice when you're starting to lose it, like get a little bit annoyed or angry or blah, blah, negative emotions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a skill. But it's worth it though. But it takes so much attention upon yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think is hard about it. Like you just have to be on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, you have to be very dedicated.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle, as I say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
So when you say that you listen to your inner body, like what it tells you to do kind of,
mm-hmm.
How do you listen to your inner body? Is it your gut, like in the stomach, or where does it come from? What's guiding you?
Yeah, I think there's many different ways to listen and there's many different traditions, but through my yogic practices over the years and especially the past year with Ashtanga has really been quite transformational for me. I could mention the chakra system.
Yeah, but
that's
sure.
That's a longer conversation perhaps.
Mm.
And I'm not extremely well versed on it, so but I think in studying the chakra system, both in a meditation practice, like doing a chakra meditation.
You can say what the chakra is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chakras. Yeah. So the chakras are, it translates to a wheel, like or an energetic wheel in the body. So it's a part of a larger group of, there's many different chakras in the body. But in here in the West, we're mostly familiar with more of the Indian Hindu perspective on the chakras, which is the 7 main chakras that run up the spine from the base of the spine to the top of the head.
We've all seen the pictures.
Yeah, we've all seen the pictures, the colored wheels,
yeah.
The mandalas. But and there's different traditions, like in Tibet, in different Tibetan traditions, there's like 4 or 5 chakras, 6 chakras. So it depends on the traditions and where they're from. And this does tie into the different vayus in the body, the different winds of the body, which ties to the nadis. The nadis are these energetic pathways. There's apparently in the yogic system, there's over 72,000 different nadis in the body. And the whole yogic practice, if I can talk about Ashtanga, for example, is about cleansing the body and preparing the body to feel these more subtle energetic channels of the body. Mm. And so I like to think that when we talk about in the West, you know, when we hear the phrase, you know, I have a gut feeling about this, or I just feel it in my heart that this is right, you know, I think we have to listen to that. And really these chakras are just, they were at the time a scientific system for understanding the physical body, the energetic body, in relation to the cosmos, in relation to the world around us. And at some point along the way, also culturally, since we're in the West, you know, we've lost that understanding. And so now we're sort of, I feel, building up our understanding of our relationship to the cosmos through modern science. Yeah. And so I'm really, as a side note, I'm really looking forward to seeing where modern science and a lot of these old traditions, lineages of spiritual practice and old sciences actually converge. And I have a feeling they absolutely will.
I have a few books on that.
Yeah, okay. Very nice.
I'll show you after.
Yeah, that would be great. Drop them in the notes at the end.
The simplest and best one is how neuroscience is catching up with Buddhism by Chris or something.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's a quite small book, but it's talking about this. And yeah, it does overlap a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, this gut feeling is so important because I feel like we've lost it. Now we're just looking at what other does on social media and we think ourselves into what we should do to reach the metrics that the culture has made for us, like success and looks and fame, more likes, you know?
Yeah.
So we think ourselves to what we should do, and our body is an intuition and gut feeling and heart is just neglected.
Yeah.
It's like, and the scary thing is we're not aware of that.
Yeah.
We're just making decisions and we think it's the best decisions for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that the getting in tune with these energies, these chakras through a daily or a practice that happens often in your life, it's just whatever that is. If you can bring your awareness to these, to the energetic body, to what you're feeling, really just what you're feeling, what the emotions are that are flowing through your body, you start to build trust with yourself. You start to really, you know, what's at the core of love?
Yeah, trust is a good word there because that's what you need, because you should not do what the other on social media does, but you have to trust what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, we hear this word embodiment being thrown around a lot, and I really think that this is actually a very beautiful word to understand, like, what this conundrum or this misunderstanding of what it means to have a purpose, or in Buddhism and in yoga we say dharma, you know, what is your dharma, what's your obligation to the world?
Yeah.
Obligation maybe has some negative connotations to it because we think that there's usually obligations to some sort of power structure, right? But this is an obligation of, like, what are we here to do and serve to others, right?
Yeah.
And I think that this is what, for me, this is what embodiment is about, is about really tuning in to understand what's happening in your body, because your body is is the one thing you have that gives you, that you have. It's a beautiful tool to give you lots of information. The nervous system is designed to connect with the outside world, to so you can feel what's happening and not just cognitively understand, which is really great. The brain is amazing.
I mean, a simple example is someone really falls on a skateboard on YouTube, and I hate to see videos like that, but if I see it, someone who really gets hurt inside my body, it's just so connected.
Right. Talk about compassion, right? Yeah. Both like saving yourself from doing that, but also like reaching out, like, hi, are you okay? Can I help? You know?
I just read about embodiment, actually, because I was like, what's the definition? And I Googled it.
Yeah.
Or I GPT'd it.
What'd the robot say?
It is to make something non-physical into material form. That's the actual definition. So a flag, a national flag, is perfect. Like the Norwegian flag, Norway, what is it? It's nothing. It's just a concept. No, wait, here. We've embodied it in a flag. So then I was thinking, oh, a teardrop is the perfect embodiment for sadness, for example.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And also, when you say embody a feeling, is if you can feel the feeling, it's kind of an embodiment. It's not material form, but you can feel it. It's there. And you can feel where in the body it is. Like, you can locate it. It exists.
Absolutely. Does that help understand the chakras a little bit more?
I'm following. Yeah. And what you're saying is that the yoga and the Ashtanga is kind of training these nodes to work better together, so you can be more sensitive and understand, for example, your gut feeling or heart feeling better.
That's part of the practice. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the primary series of Ashtanga is called Yoga Chikitsa, which translates to basically therapy or the healing practice.
Yeah.
So it's yoga for healing. It's yoga therapy for not to be confused with the modern practice of yoga therapy, which is combining like psychotherapy and yoga together. But this is the therapy of the body. So it's really about, the primary series is really about healing. There's a lot of forward folds. There are a lot of postures in the beginning and in the middle, the beginning and the end. There are postures that bring us back to these sort of fetal-like positions. And I think this is really interesting, because I think it really taps into the memory of the body and why we carry, why the body is intelligent that way, right? And so it's sort of about unraveling the body, like just gently opening it.
Yeah, so that's exactly how I feel. I actually went to your Ashtanga course, which I loved, and I still do it often. And opening up, I feel like opening up, more connected with the world, with my body. It's just such a good feeling. You always feel amazing after yoga.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, every
I'm
yoga.
I'm gonna open the window.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I'm just gonna walk past the mic.
Yeah.
Try not to. Because the machine outside is stopped.
Yeah.
So and it's
beautiful.
Let's do the burps instead.
Fresh air on the summer day.
I feel that.
Oof. And the river.
All right. Oh, yeah, the river. Gosh. The birds came in. What a change.
Yeah, here we are.
And the fresh air. Yoga is good for you. Nature is good for you.
Oh, yeah. They are one and the same, really.
Yeah.
But
the one the same.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're natural beings.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to say about Ashtanga, you know, you can have this experience in any yoga class. The reason why I have fallen in love with Ashtanga is because of the repetition, actually. Because it brings it's like a massage on the nervous system. It brings me back to a place where the nervous system can go, okay, yeah, I know what's happening. And then I can also go deeper into my energetic experience in my body.
Yeah,
this comes back to all practices, really. I mean, it's said in meditation as well. Go find go explore some different paths, see what works for you,
yeah,
and then stick to it. Because then you can...
You can't always discover anything new.
Yeah.
It's why it's so good, feels so good brushing your teeth, because you just, I know I can do this. I know exactly how to do it. It's a routine. We love routine. So yeah, when you find your kind of practice, if it's meditation or yoga, whatever, just stick to it for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll change, but...
Yeah, exactly.
But just stick to it as long as it feels good.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, Ashtanga yoga is a set. It's a process that you do every time the same postures.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not like the instructor tells you, now we're going to do a new posture that you don't know about. It. You always know. It's a map.
Yeah, it's a map. And it's designed to empower the students so they can have their own home practice.
Yeah.
Which I think is also really important.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it reminds me of kids, right? I mean, kids... Just as we talked once, you know, they just want to feel safe. They want to feel that there's something familiar, right?
Mm.
And I think it's about this as well. It's just coming back home to yourself.
And like my kid, she wants to read the same book over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's not even a great book. We just rent some new at library at Deitman, And I'm like, what book do you want to read today? That one again. And she just loves going through the same story again.
Yeah.
Even though she knows what happens in the end.
Yeah. You know? Or maybe she likes how Dada reads the characters, you know?
Yeah, but it's something about like Ashtanga. Or brush your teeth. You just go through the same thing. It feels so good.
Yeah.
You know you like this.
Yeah.
And then probably after 20 times, she would change. And that's then it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But in Ashtanga, then you just move on to the next level. Yeah.
Yeah, and then that's the beauty of the practice as well. Then you sort of play like, okay, am I getting attached to, is this like an asana game? Am I trying to collect asanas in my little asana bank? You know?
Yeah.
Or is it something else, right? And so then I think you're sort of like, okay, yeah, this is where I'm gonna be for now, and I'm gonna explore this and I think
it's always gonna change.
It's always going to change.
Impermanence.
Impermanence, baby.
I want to go back to the gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I have one more question there.
Mm-hmm.
It's about intuition, isn't it? Like the gut feeling. I think of gut feeling a lot like intuition. It's coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I have like an intuition or motivation, it just comes through me, I have to do this, or... I can't do that. You know, mm-hmm. It just tells you.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from?
So this is interesting because I think that this actually comes back to the chakras for me.
Yeah.
I find that it's a great tool to understand the chakras because each chakra sort of aligns with a different aspect of your life or life experience.
Hmm.
So... I feel that the more that I attune my awareness to the chakras or to where I'm feeling sensations in the body, and not just the seven main chakras, but I'm not so knowledgeable about the other chakras.
Yeah.
But I think it's also worthy to note, like, why do I keep having a twitch in my baby finger? You know, maybe I should just sort of keep a log in my brain. Like, why is it twitch anything? I don't know. But so I, just to say that there's many sensations that can happen in the body, not just, you know, the gut or the heart. But I think it's really important to recognize these different sensations and why they arise. And for example, you can have a sensation at the root chakra and oftentimes at the base of the spine. That sensation is usually connected to safety, security, family. Right.
Talking about embodying, like you can feel there it is.
Boom. Feel that's where it is.
Yeah.
Feel something in your heart. Love, compassion.
Yeah. This is so fascinating because,
you know,
I don't know much about the chakras. I haven't really read much about it. But yeah, safety all the way down there.
Mm-hmm.
Love definitely comes from the heart.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
If people stop and feel, they can't deny that.
Why is my throat tightening up?
Yeah.
confidence, yeah. not being heard,
yeah.
not being able to speak clearly what you're trying to say, mm. you know?
Something about truth, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, mm. yeah.
Very interesting. So, yeah. so, and also when I'm asking, like, where does it come from? I'm thinking it's just some life force. I think we have to go back to the bigger universe and it's just sending it through you in a way.
Mm.
I mean, it's not like... Like, it has to come from somewhere.
yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Or something awakens it in you.
I mean, it's the second law of physics, right? That for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I mean, mm. it's just like, nothing ever dies
mm.
in existence. It just keeps expanding and changing and morphing into something else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good... You've opened the door to a very big question that many people have been trying to answer for many years.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to answer that one today.
But I think it's a great one. I mean, yeah, are you asking the question to the universe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're part of it, so, and you have a mouth, so... So go on.
I have a tiny, itty bitty mouth.
Yeah, no, we can leave it there. I really enjoyed this talk about gut feeling and bringing in the chakras and Ashtanga to it. It's very interesting. I've never done that.
Yeah, I do feel that. I'm going to attempt to ride this door opening a little bit and see where maybe it goes to something else.
Mm. Yeah.
I feel that we are a materialization of something much greater. That this is just another expression of something that is like vibrational, that is a frequency, right? Mm. Like light is frequency, sound is frequency.
Mm.
I'm not going to dare to say like what frequency it exists upon, like what dimension of frequency it is. But I do feel like it is a frequency that vibrates, right? It creates friction or tension and then it expresses in the body because this is how we feel the world around us is through more compact material form, matter, that's in this own little microcosmos that we call the body. I feel that it's just a it's sort of like a domino effect, you know. You feel something, then I feel something.
Mm.
The depth at which I feel what you feel is probably not the same depth, or that it's maybe transmuted based on my past experiences, which are just vibrational frequencies that are like residing still in my atoms in my body.
Mm.
So I think it's like. These are just sort of friction of vibration to me. And how can we harmonize? It's like, how do we create jazz with our different vibrations?
Is this the same when people talk about you have some kind of positive energy or negative energy? Is it the energy term? Is that the frequencies here? Like,
sure. Yeah. I was trying to avoid saying the word energy because I think it's so elusive, you know. I once dated a scientist, a biologist, and we had a great time because we always sort of playfully argued about, like, what is energy? You know, and because she never really understood it, but she wasn't, she wasn't a physicist, she was a biologist, so she's really much into, like, the physical world.
Yeah.
My first teacher... Max Romano, he was an astrophysicist, worked for NASA and Lockheed Martin and around the world building rockets and planes.
Really?
Really cool dude. Yeah. Like the way that he explained yoga philosophy through analogy of physics was brilliant.
Yeah,
just brilliant. Like really makes you understand the relationship of these old philosophies with the modern world.
Yeah,
it's very beautiful, I think.
I think I've seen something similar from Alan Watts.
Yeah.
When he's talking about off and on, everything is just off and on, like frequencies. We sleep, we're awake. We're sad, we're happy. Mm. We're this, we're that. Everything is just like ongoing.
Yeah.
I was just reminded that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is like that. It's like equations of frequencies, right?
Yeah. And in the yin and yang, if the black fish eats the white fish, black fish is non-existent, you know. So we have to have this on and off, go back and forth. We need both.
Mm-hmm.
And there we are in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Ongoing.
Yeah.
Never ending.
So let's go on to the ego.
Okay.
How much time do we have?
Oh, we're good. We've got like 30 minutes.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Because
it's a long way from being an actor in Hollywood to being a Zen person walking amongst the trees in Oslo. Have your ego become smaller in this process? It's just so interesting with this ego thing.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to my partner the other day about this a little bit, and she mentioned, as we were talking about this book that I'm reading, similar to maybe what you're reading about neuroscience and Buddhism. It's a book with the lectures that are happening between scientists and the Dalai Lama.
Oh,
yeah, really great book. And she said, Dalai Lama, he's got a bit of an ego, you know.
Sirius said that.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, when you think about it, like, the ego is a really great tool. And you really kind of, like, if you're a deep spiritual human being that is, like, your life's work is to spread love and compassion throughout the world, and you have to sit on a stage or on, you know, in front of the world and world leaders, talking to world leaders and scientists, and getting some of the hardest questions.
Mm.
Like, I think you got to have some. I mean, we're mortal beings. Mm. Like, our egos are here for a reason. And I guess my answer to you is I don't think my ego is any smaller. I just think that I've learned to manage it better.
Yeah, and I love how you said that it's a tool.
It can be, or it can be like, it can, where, yeah, maybe, yeah, it's a tool, and it can, like, all of a sudden, it's like taking over you, you know, or it can take over you. Like, you're driving a car and you can choose to drive the car. Or, you know, and be aware of the other cars and people around you, and recognize, like, yeah, I'm a being, that's a being, and this is dangerous, and gotta be safe. Or you can sort of identify with your beautiful Bentley and, you know, and you drive however fast you want, and right?
Mm.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah, tool is a good way to describe it. But yeah, I feel that my ego isn't necessarily any smaller. I think at times it challenges me.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that, I had realized when I had finally taken my teacher training, it was one of those things that was my bucket list, and I again just never really had the courage to go do. And then I finally did it. I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. This is sort of combining all of the aspects of my life together, and of course one of them being acting, like being in front of people, holding space, telling a story with your words, whether that's, even if it's just telling a story of how to stand into an asana.
But you can do that without having much of an ego.
Ego
is when you identify to that role. I'm a good yoga teacher.
Sure. Cool. Yeah. Sure. Yeah,
look at me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Instagram is a perfect practice of challenging the ego.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The business of spirituality. It's a very weird place to be.
And then it makes sense what you're saying, that you need the ego as a tool to spread, for example, spiritual knowledge and wisdom.
I think to act in the world, right? Yeah. Like, because we are all actors on a stage, as someone once famous said.
Yeah.
And, you know, the world is a stage and we are all but merely players.
Yeah, and we're not humans having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And here we are in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just the fact that this microphone is here is changing. It's like the Greek chorus, right?
Uh-huh.
If this microphone wasn't here, it would change the quality of our conversation now. Of course, we're landing, or at least attempting, I'm attempting to land in being very present with you and seeing you and hearing your voice and talking with you from an open-hearted place.
Mm.
But the reality is I know that this is here, and there's a whole world, or potential world, that could hear this.
Yeah.
You know? And again, it's all in my mind, because maybe you don't even release this.
Yeah.
You know? Or maybe this doesn't, no one ever hears this. Maybe this stays in this box that has an apple on it forever until it deteriorates thousands of years from now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but you have to try to forget that. As the Zen master said, it was a boxing match,
mm-hmm.
and the guy who was supposed to win, he was really poor.
Yeah,
he didn't do his best, and a student asked, "Why is he being so poor? He's boxing so poorly."
Yeah,
and the Zen master said, "His need to win drains him of power.
Mm.
He's just not there."
Because
the ego thinking that now I have to win.
Yes, 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 yes.
And when I heard that story, it resonated so hard, because I played football as a young kid, an adult my whole life. And when we were, for example, under 2-1, it's 5 minutes left, I always played so bad, because thinking we have to get that goal, we have to win fame, we have to win this cup. And everything I did was just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's the ego. That's your brain thinking yourself into poor performance. It's kind of the opposite to flow, almost.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
Like, you can flow here with this microphone,
mm-hmm.
or you can start thinking, oh, what would the audience think of what I just said now? And mm-hmm. and if you start to think of that, it's just not going to be a good performance.
No.
You're going to lose the boxing match.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but there is something interesting about that, which we explored in theater, in my theater history class and performance art classes, which is like, you know, you have to acknowledge the space, and you have to acknowledge the audience, and yet you have to completely be in the moment.
Yeah.
And to me, that's like, that to me sort of, this is where I feel spirituality and performance are like, that there is an absolute connection, and that there's no big, there's no big surprise that they came from one another. Because if you look at
do they come from one another? Performance and spirituality?
Well, like, for example, think about people sitting around a fire, you know, back before we had developed agriculture, right?
Mm.
And they're telling the story of the lion that ate their friend.
Yeah.
You know? And then, out of nowhere, there's this insight into the nature of reality through the experience of this man's friend who died.
Mm.
And a collective understanding of the nature around them, or the experience around them in the fire, this community of people listening to this story, right? Because this man has an audience, and he feels something and he's trying to communicate this story.
Yeah.
And then his child, years later, tells the same story. And then in that story develops meaning, right? Like, not only practical tools of what to do or not to do around a lion, but like, it cannot not be imbued with meaning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I see that totally.
So I think that this, I think that, that it really is, I think having a spiritual practice in your life sort of creates this environment for you to be more aware of your actions as though you have a Greek chorus watching you all the time, right? And here, this is where I think there's a lot of trauma in our culture around spirituality, because there's a lot of oppression, there's a lot of taking power of people by saying, hey, we're watching you, you shouldn't do that, be careful.
Yeah,
you know. But to have to sort of feel as though you're a part of something much greater that is, that has consequences, that has karmic repercussions, you know, and not necessarily bad karmic repercussions that are positive as well. And I try to avoid bad and good, because I think it, again, I think this like taps into our cultural traumas around spirituality, and rather it happened. This thing happened. This is again coming back to, for every action there's an equal opposite reaction, right?
Yeah, you thought it was bad losing your job in the bar.
Yeah. But deep down, like right after, I was like, oh God, this kind of feels so good.
Yeah. So I teach and I also sing in a band, and
I saw those pictures of you on stage in the video.
Yeah.
That was like power.
Yeah, I'm a very feminine guy, but on stage I'm not.
Yeah.
I just change, and I don't know. Don't know what happens.
There's something there.
That's just how it is.
That's great.
But anyway, after becoming more spiritual, so much easier to be in the now teaching or performing.
Really? You find it more easier?
Yeah, because I can think back,
find it easier,
to 5 years ago in the classroom or on stage, and it was a lot of thoughts going on.
Yeah.
What if I say this? What if I do that? Will the audience like me better after the gig? Or will the students like me more if I do this or this now? And like many thoughts that takes me out of the moment, also like out of the flow and the great performance, or half great, whatever.
But it brings you more.
Yeah,
it connects you.
Yeah,
more.
Now I can just go in there and just be in the now a lot, maybe 99%. Maybe I lose it a little bit here and there, but it almost never happens anymore.
Yeah.
And it's great for performance. But that's like Michael Jordan meditated, you know. Kobe Bryant, a lot. He was a pro meditator.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. You know, Chicago Bulls was the first team that I know of in sport that started meditating. It was through their coach.
Wow.
And they just won everything the season after he came. And then Kobe Bryant was the best, wasn't he, for so many years. He was the hardest meditator.
I have a good friend who here in Norway, she used to be Michael Jordan's like private chef. And she was like, he's the nicest guy.
He is, yeah.
He's so nice. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of celebrities are nice. They're just people too. But she was saying, yeah, he's really great. He was really great to work for. So
Michael Jordan, legend. Yeah. All right. So what's going to happen now? Are you going to LA?
No, I'll be flying into San Francisco. So I used to live in LA.
Oh, you go in San Francisco?
Yeah, I lived in Hollywood.
That's where you grew up, right? Time. On that farm with the dogs and the animals.
Yeah, so that's about an hour and a half east of San Francisco, northeast.
Yeah.
And so I go to, I fly tomorrow, and I'll be there for almost 6 weeks. And I'm going to have some workshops and just building some connections and meeting some new people. And then I'll be, throughout that time, just spending time with family, connecting, you know, getting to know some of my friends and family again after a long time of not being so connected.
It's so important. Like it is indirectly, it's taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
Just... the most important stepping stone. Don't forget your family, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I feel it more now as a dad, as a stepdad. I feel like it's really been such a great mirror back on onto the importance of connecting with family, being there for my parents, and so I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah. And I'll be back in August and starting up a new schedule, and
And people have to follow you if they've listened to this. So you're mostly active on Instagram.
Yeah, that's sort of my business platform. I launched my new website this week. So
cool,
making it easier for people because I'm trying to do some more one-on-one work and
retreats.
And retreats, yeah.
And it's Jeff Frieders on Instagram, or
J Frieders on Instagram.
Frieders.
J Frieders, FRIEDERS on Instagram, and then jefffrieders.com. So
can't wait to see the website.
Yeah, I'm working with this girl named Vilda Voldak.
Yeah, I follow her. I think.
Yeah,
I follow many yogis.
Voldevik, yeah, Vilda Voldevik. She has Viva Media. She's great. Yeah. I really love her. And I have another friend of mine who is a student, Reme. She's been integral. She's actually helping me with my brand. She's user experience. So that's been cool.
Handy.
Yeah, that's really handy. Yeah. But it's been, it's been really fun to develop what is a brand. I mean, coming back to identity and sort of,
getting spiritual there.
Yeah.
Identity and values.
Yeah, actually, you have to clearly communicate who you are to people these days.
All the best brands totally know deep down who they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been a really, actually, very valuable process and worth the investment of time and energy. And I'm so grateful for the community of people to help with that. So, you can follow me there and we have some retreats coming out, both myself and then my partner and I, this year, and already planning for next year. So check it out.
And let's go to retreats instead of going to other kind of holidays.
Yeah, man. I mean, or, you know.
It's my new holiday. It's just a retreat.
It's somewhere. So great. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to a few other people in the biz, in the industry, as they say.
You can't say that word as a yogi anymore.
No. Yeah. Shh, don't say the word. Yeah. But I think it's really important that we, as people who are making space for others and going, seeking to go deeper on our own spiritual path, I think it's so important to take time away to go on our own journeys and our own retreats. I think ideally I would love to do that for a couple of months out of the year, to just retreat away from society and to not be connected to the phone, and to take that time to really land in myself and with my loved ones. And I think it's what are we here for in this life,
you're asking me?
Yeah, sure.
I think we're here to explore. We can explore whatever we want as long as we like it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But then it comes back to do what you want. Mm. Don't follow the culture or whatever other people do. Like, you're here to explore in your way.
Mm. Mm.
If you're a scientist within biology or a philosopher, just explore your thing. I think we're here as a small part of the universe, exploring ourselves as the universe.
Yeah.
With eyes and ears and our senses and cognitive capabilities. And just understand it. This weird thing that we don't understand at all. But we're doing baby steps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Hakon. It's been so lovely to be here with you today. It was such a pleasure to get to know you, and over the past, I guess, like 6 months it's been. About 6-8 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Look forward to chatting with you more.
Same. And thank you so much for visiting my little living room.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Wow. This is spiritual right here. Yeah. Just looking out on that river.
Did you notice in the middle of the podcast when we opened the window?
Yeah.
It just changed so much when the birds came in and the
so
river.
So different.
Yeah. People live amongst birds and water. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Cheers, man.
Takk for at du lyttet til Spirituell. Hvis du likte det, ja, så følg oss. Og gjerne snakk om det til en som betyr noe for deg. Ha en fin dag.